Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Leviticus 21 through Leviticus 24. And it covers, of course, obviously includes the famous chapter of Leviticus 23 regarding the holidays and such. It's a somewhat lengthy section. As far as any comments or questions before I get into my spiel, there's quite a bit to discuss here. If you do have a question or comment, I may or may not get to it, so you can ask it now. Just unmute yourself or wave your hand or whatever.
And we'll Daniel? Discuss
it. Yes, ma'am.
Could you explain to me what it means in verse 15 of 21 to profane your seed among the people? What does that mean?
So let's read it again. It says, this verse 15 of chapter 21 of Leviticus, it says, "Thus shall he," referring to the high priest, "shall not desecrate his offspring or profane his offspring among his people, for I am Jehovah who sanctifies him." So in the case, that is describing the details as far as who he can or cannot marry, or who he should or should not marry, and who he has relations with. So the idea or the intent is that he will select a fitting wife that is acceptable as far as offspring is concerned. I do not wish to have offspring of somebody who is an unfit wife. And the unfit wife is described there as one who, if for the high priest in particular, is one who is either a divorced woman, a widowed woman, a harlot, or a desecrated woman. So any of those categories, he is not to have a wife from, but rather his wife must be from of his people, so it implies through Levi, but may not necessarily be isolated to the tribe of Levi, but among his wife, who must be a virgin. That's the pretty basic fundamental idea. So how is it that a child, I should ask you this question, how is it a child from a profaned or an unacceptable wife would be profane, his offspring would become profane? So we have to ask ourselves, does that mean that the actions of the parents, actually the parents, can classify or group the offspring into that profane category? The answer is absolutely yes. The actions of parents can affect their child. So if you have a wife that has been divorced or one that is a widowed, she has already been used, so to speak, by a previous husband or one who's a harlot by a previous man, then God does not want his high priest to marry that particular woman. Now, that is not quite the same rules as for all priests. Note that in the other categories of priests, they are permitted to marry a widow. But the high priest, however, is not. So the widow is not a requirement for all priests, but it is the high priest. So yes, your parents have to be, relatively speaking, clean for you to be clean. It's just how it's going to work. God has it set up that way. Any questions or comments regarding that particular topic? We'll discuss that more thoroughly later on, because Ezekiel chapter 44 goes in great detail about, or greater detail, about an additional alteration or change that happens to the descendants of the high priest. And we'll discuss that in Ezekiel 44 when we get there today. It's part of the Haftor portion. Some people do not like Ezekiel 44, well, Ezekiel the whole book for that matter, because there are certain sections that seem to contradict or alter the Torah. And that's something which we'll discuss a little bit. Like I've said many times in the past, I am not a person who believes that there are no contradictions in the Bible. I think there are quite a few. It helps you understand them. The Bible is a two-dimensional book, so to speak, not a 2D book. So there are depths that are more valuable by understanding the contradictions than they are by just taking them at face value. Hope that makes sense. Any comments or questions? Yes, Don.
Yeah, what is this? It's chapter 22, verse looks like 25. And the first part seems very easy to understand. It says, from the hand of a foreigner, you may not offer the bread of your God. For any of these four, their corruption is in them, a blemish is in them, they will not find favor for you. I don't understand that.
So that's taken two different ways, two different possibilities, just to say. The most common possibility, which I'm not saying this is right, I'm just giving you both of them, you can decide what you think it means. Mm-hmm. But the most common possibility is that, as it specified early in the previous, almost eight verses or so, the different offerings that you can or cannot offer, something has a blemish, a broken limb, or some strange thing with the animal, that whether it is yours or whether it comes from a foreigner, neither are acceptable. That's one possibility, one viewpoint. That's not supposed to be the I personally subscribe to, but that's one possibility. The other is that you may not offer it on behalf of a stranger. That's a possibility as far as what it's referring to. So a stranger, for example, you're allowed to go to the temple under certain circumstances, but strangers are not. So if the stranger wishes to offer an offering, they may be unclean or whatever, they can ask you to do it on their behalf. Well, that's not permissible. You can't do that either. The other last possibility, this is the first, which is what I personally think is what it's actually referring to, is that God wants the animal to come from you, from your supplies, your stock, your stuff, not from somebody else's. That's my personal opinion. That's what I think it means, is that, for example, as David pointed out, if something doesn't cost me anything, it doesn't mean anything. If it costs me something, that I will offer to God. So in my opinion, that's what the intent is, that it is to cost you something. Now, be in mind, I'm not a person who raises animals. I just don't. I don't have animals. I don't raise them. I don't grow them. I don't. I'll catch a fish, but I don't grow them either. I don't eat them. I don't grow them. I eat them. That's what I close to animals who are alive. And so I don't participate in that. So I personally, if I needed for some reason to offer an offering to God, I would be forced to go buy one because I don't have any. Now, in my opinion, the intent is that it must be offered by you or for you on your behalf. So in my opinion, I think that means that I am to attempt to acquire this animal and attempt to raise it or for some reason. So for example, I have another way of wording it. Let's imagine for a moment you did something you need to make an offering for. I don't care what it is. Imagine it is. It's just something. And you don't have an animal. So you go across the way, you find some Joe Schmo who sells or raises, birds or something like that, or something else that you don't have. You go, here's some money, you buy the thing, you walk to the temple, and you slaughter it. Did that mean anything to you? I mean, you lost some money. That's about it. Now, on the other hand, let's say you raised the animal. You took the effort to grow it. You took care of it, fed it, and all those things, that went with that animal. Then you have to select the animal, make sure it's nice and good, in good condition, and go offer it. The animal is more than just money now. It's your labor. It's your effort. It's your strength. And it meant more. It meant a lot more. So I think the intent is that. That's my opinion as the intent. Now, I can't say for certain it's right, but that's my intent. Yes, Don.
I like your interpretation and your intent. And I think for me, I have personal experience with that because I have raised animals. And even though I was born and raised as a city boy, we moved out to the country and we got chickens and a number of other things, right? So we were taking care of these little bitty chicks. And before we got them, hey, we can have eggs. And guess what? We can make chicken stew. I had those birds and my wife. In one or two days, we said, we're never going to butcher these animals. This isn't going to happen.
Yeah,
It's funny how that affects you. Yeah. Imagine if you grew up on a farm and that was your everyday life, it may not affect you as much. But, it's designed to mean something to you.
Yeah.
That was the intended design. That is my opinion. It's my interpretation of what that verse means. I gave you all the different options. You can choose whatever you want or make up your own. I don't care. The point is that they're different. Interpretation of what it meant, and that's how I view it, is the intent is it is not from a stranger. Now, it does not necessarily say you couldn't buy it from a fellow member or a fellow tribes member. It's from a stranger. So you're referring to who's outside another country, like, for example, where it's just the Israelites. Wouldn't it be buying it from an Egyptian or buying it from somebody from the Hittite territory or from someone? That's the intent of being by strangers, somebody who's outside your territory and outside your growth, your area. So the corruption being on them would be from their land they came from, regardless of who it is. So the idea is that it's far removed from you. That's how I interpret it. Now, I could be wrong. That's how I interpret it. And the comments or questions I can answer now, because I may not get to all these in my little spiel.
Yeah, Daniel, let's check in with some of the people on the phone.
Hey, Larry, you're sharing your screen.
Yeah, can you unshare it, Larry? Ah, thank you. Are there other comments, questions, and we'll go into our spiel then. So in this Torah portion, that was Leviticus chapter 21 through 24, there's a whole bunch of stuff in there. I'm not going to cover all of it. I'll just cover through a good portion of it. If you have any questions or comments, by all means, do so.
I'd like you to explain, yes, when you get to chapter 24, I really want to know what it means to blaspheme God.
Oh, okay. Hopefully we'll get to that. Actually, hold on. Let me look at my little chart.
I need a real clear interpretation of that. Because I don't want to do it.
Let's see here. I'm looking at my slideshow. Make sure they cover the topic of exactly his blaspheming, not the words he spoke. I didn't insist that. So in general speaking, when you guys are blaspheming God, so there's lots of different beliefs about this, and I will not tell you what you must believe or think. I'll just show you how I view this, because to me, it's pretty straightforward and pretty simple. But there are a lot of different opinions on this. So in my viewpoint, blaspheming God is you are cursing him. It is to, the idea, of course, is to bring God's name low and that you make common. But this is more than just common. This is taking God's name in vain or making it low or common would be against the commandment. But blaspheming him, you are cursing him. Now, this is going to be interpreted broadly or narrowly. So in the term of broadly, you can say, well, God said me to do this, and he didn't. Well, that's a broad interpretation. I can say, well, I just blasphemed God. On the other hand, you can very narrowly and say, unless I say blank, blank you, God, some curse words, that's a very narrow interpretation where I have to say something very specific against him. That's a narrow interpretation. You can interpret it broadly or narrowly or somewhere in between. To me personally, I do my best to try to translate or view it as broadly as possible and leave room for error. So in my instance, for example, if I believe God's told me to do something, I will say, I believe God asked me to do this. I think this is what he said. I use the qualifier words of believe or think, not declaring that he did or did not. If I declare he did or did not, I am now taking the place of a prophet. I am not a prophet. I cannot declare what God did or did not do or will or will not conduct in the future. He doesn't speak to me that way. I will not pretend to act like he does. Now, I do believe there are various things I've seen him do in people's lives, my life, lives of your life, various people's lives. And I've seen him act and do things that are seemingly at first hard or difficult. and ask, well, okay, God, is this you or is it not? Not to openly give him credit for things that are against you. But when it turns out for your better or my better, I then determine, okay, God, yeah, clearly it was from you. So blaspheming him will be, in my opinion, a broad spectrum form of giving him or putting blame on his shoulders that he may or may not have done. Sometimes humans do things ourselves and we blame God for it. Sometimes God does stuff and we think we did it. So it's a matter of credit and what you give credit for. That's the broad spectrum, the broad brush, the biggest, largest viewpoint you can think of, at least I can think of. In the narrow sense, which I will not say the narrow sense is not correct, the narrow sense is a condemnation. If you recall correctly, believe Messiah had pointed out, I do not recall the address of where it's written. Some of you might research it and figure it out. Where he said it that cursing the Spirit of God is a non-forgivable sin, but the cursing the Son is. Well, in the form of Spirit, of course, referred there is God the Father he's talking about. So cursing the Father is a non-forgivable or unforgiven sin. Cursing the Son, however, is not. So in that sense of the term, it would be a slightly narrower version of what I view as broad objection. He's narrowed it down very specifically to cursing against or speaking against our God. Now, God has had many people speak against him. One in particular, those who speak against him are the form of shortening his hand, saying, oh, God can't do that. Or God, this is too difficult for you. We have discussed many of those people in the past. As far as the Torah discusses them and the Tanakh discusses them. And most of them end up dead for various reasons. But so shortening God's hand, he doesn't apparently like either. So don't claim he cannot do something when in fact he can. So shortening his hand would be declaring against him or blaming him would be declaring against him. And those things which Messiah was very adamant about, don't do. And our story examples throughout our Tanakh say the same thing. Do not shorten his hand and do not blame him. He is responsible for things that are good for us. Whether they appear good at first or not doesn't matter. He's responsible for them. But beware who you blame. Does it make sense? Hopefully it makes sense. You can decide how you think it is and what you think is fair in that verse, that description. This is how I view it based on when I look at each story and all the different examples of people who shortened his hand, end up dead. People who blamed him, end up dead. So both those two things, saying he can't do something when he can, say he can't do something which he, or say that he did do something which he didn't. He doesn't take kindly to them either way. Either way, you perish. So whatever the blaspheming definition is, you can interpret it as you see fit. I interpret it as broadly as possible for me.
Daniel, this is Priscilla. Can I ask you a question?
By all means.
Didn't one of Job's friends say, why don't you curse God and die?
Correct.
I was just thinking, in light of what you just explained, it wouldn't be like, well, why would he die? It would be like, because God would take him out.
Right? That's the idea that God would take him out.
Okay, all right. Well, I just saw that in a different way.
Yeah. I think it was his wife who said that. I can't remember if his friend did or not, but it was wife.
Oh, his wife. Okay.
One of them did. There. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. All right.
That's the idea. Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up because I put it into context, really. Thank you.
So it was a big deal. And so we try to make things as, like I said, there's, you can interpret different ways. I look at, if I'm not understanding interpretation, I typically just read all the different examples I can find and try to get a broad spectrum viewpoint. This is about what it must be or something similar to it within the story context. So, Rose, I don't believe you're in risk of blaspheming God necessarily, but yeah, that's between you and him and I wouldn't know. So, hopefully makes sense.
Well, for the record, it was his wife.
It was his wife? Okay, thank you.
He said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. You know, shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?
Good.
But she said, curse God and die. Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God. Oh my God.
Give it up. Get over it. No, oh. I wouldn't want to be married to her. No offense to Joe, but, or her either. It's just a hard stereo. I've let you go through things that I would even nightmarishly would not want to go through, but still, it's not an easy thing.
All right. Just check in with some of the people on the phone here.
Sounds good. Myrna, Anna, Joanne, Journey.
I don't have someone who's,
who's come in with a phone number ending in 990.
That's Pat.
That's me, Pat.
Oh, hi, Pat. Shabbat Shalom to you.
Hi. Shabbat Shalom. I just listened. It's interesting.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and share my presentation here. I'm going to share screen. This will not cover everything, but just the core of what we're discussing today. There'll be a few comments, a few strange stuff, but nothing too complicated. So, Emor, the section of Leviticus 21 through 24 discusses the first obviously couple chapters, which we already read it, of course. Leviticus 21 through 22 discusses most of contamination details, the contents of priests, and other details. As I mentioned, also the half Torah portion of this is Ezekiel chapter 44. That discusses also details regarding the priests and their conduct. So conduct and contamination details as well as clarification is also included in Ezekiel 44. He clarifies some details that the Torah leaves out, as well as there's a contradiction, actually, there's a couple of them. A contradiction is in Ezekiel 44. As mentioned before, I'm not a believer that the Bible has zero contradictions, and it's not true. It actually does, and does it on purpose. I believe it does on purpose because no two witnesses say the same thing. If you have two identical witnesses say the exact same thing, one's lying. They're a copy. One copied the other person, they didn't see the same thing. You cannot have two humans see the same thing, have the exact same story. You can have multiple witnesses, multiple stories, they vary some. That tells you how more accurately it's true. It's just how humans work because we interpret what we see. We don't just see, we interpret it. And so witnesses interpret what they see with based on their experience. I've never seen a witness do otherwise. So that's how it works. If those of you experience it differently, that's so be it. In Leviticus 23, it says this is Moedim, or the appointed times. We'll discuss it as well. Obviously, it includes in Shabbat, which we are all very familiar with, as well as Passover and the days of Matzot. It also has the Omer, the counting of the Omer is also listed there, as well as the ending of that counting, which is in Shavuot. Then it jumps to the fall feast, which is Yom Teruah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, and then Shmini Atzeret. These are all the different, I guess, the overall categories or appointed times. There is technically one missing in this list. Leviticus 23 does not discuss Rosh Kodesh or New Moons. That's discussed later on in another section, another Torah portion. But this covers these core examples, and there's, in my opinion, a reason why these are all grouped here and Rosh Kodesh is not, because all these are centered around the number 7, and Rosh Kodesh is not centered around number 7. That is around 12 or 13, depending on how many months they happen to be in a given year. But these are all centered around the number 7, so they are grouped together as such. And they also have, I also mentioned here in Leviticus 23, there's a list of all these different holidays, appointed times. Those appointed times are not the same as the list of appointments. So, for example, we have Shabbat has one appointment every 7 days. It is the Shabbat itself. Passover has technically doesn't even officially have an appointment per se. But it's an evening of a particular appointed day. Matzot, the day of Matzot, actually has two appointments in it. There's the first appointment, the first day, and the seventh day, the second appointment, with inside the days of unleavened bread. The count, the Omer, does not have an appointment. It doesn't contain any. So though these are all lists of appointed times, the appointments themselves are not necessarily within inside these lists. The appointments themselves are not there. They are they're intermixed among them at a different order. So the count of the Omer does not have an appointment, but Shavuot does. It has an appointment. When I'm referring to an appointment, I'm referring to a time which you will stop what you are doing and you will go to wherever God places his name and you'll spend time with him. That's what I'm referring to as an appointment. For example, you have obviously Yom Teruah, which is an appointment, is a time which you will stop and go visit with him. Yom Kippur is an appointment. Sukkot is 7 days long, but only has one appointment, which is the first day of Sukkot. The remaining 6 days, they are not an appointment. It's not, they are to be observed. They aren't an appointment. Now, the eighth day, Shemini Atzeret, is an additional appointment. There's a time which you will stop what you are doing, and theoretically speaking, God will stop what he is doing to come visit with you or meet that appointment. So holidays have different lists of than the appointed times. They're just they're divided up a little bit differently. They're arranged differently. And then at the last chapter of the 24, we discuss this grouping of sevens because there's a few other things are grouped in there. And of course, the strange blaspheming story, which we'll get to as well. That's the route we're going to take. Should be done within the hour. So this shouldn't take too long, actually. These are pretty straightforward stuff. So the death of a relative in normal human life, obviously people live, the people die. That's how it works. Life is old Bosch would say, is a terminal condition. It kills everybody and no one lives through it. And so it's going to come, it's going to end. So in the case of unlike our modern day world, when someone dies, we call up the preacher, we call up the funeral home, whatever it happens to be, or if it's a hospital, the hospital, take care of the dead body. And we have others take care of it for us. That is not normal as far as the history is concerned, how human is concerned. Normal way of taking care of bodies is the family takes care of the body. Whether it be a husband, a wife, a father, a child, the parents, the children, the spouses, they're the ones who take the body. They're the ones who arrange for its burial. They're the ones who carry it to the burial. And they're the ones who put it in the ground and bury it, or in a cave or some whatever you got cut out for them, for their dead body to decompose. Priests do not attend. Preachers do not attend. Other medical qualified people do not attend. These are events which is a private matter for families. Now, however, in the case of priests, and as far as the Torah is concerned, there are specific requirements or additional requirements put upon them. In Leviticus 21, the first six verses discusses a regular priest verse around this topic. Verses 10 through 12 discuss the high priests in this topic, where this isn't just the relative death part. So, of course, in normal priests, they are not to conduct or attend funerals. So if their friend dies, they don't get to go. If their wife dies, they don't get to go. Sounds strange. That's how it works. So the priests are a separate group, a separate category, and this is their conduct that's expected of them. In the first six verses of 21, it discusses, says, Jehovah says Moses, sons of Aaron, tell them you shall not condemn yourself to a dead person among his people. God doesn't want contamination. Doesn't want to now, mind you, when you are condemned with a dead body, there's a period of washing, and then you have to do the red heifer water, which is basically lye water mixed. And there's a time period for cleansing for dead bodies and such. The priests are not to contaminate themselves. Now there are some exceptions. You have to be around and somebody just drops dead in front of you. Okay. You didn't have a choice matter, you're contaminated. If you enter a house, for example, someone's dead, then you're contaminated too. So things can happen by accident, but it's not intended to be done by purpose. The exception being, of course, for a regular priest is the relative who's closest to him. This includes his mother and father, his son or daughter, his brother, or to his virgin sister. Note, wife is not included. Uncle is not included. Even grandparent is not included. And this is the closest relatives that normal priests are to can be at the funeral or near the dead body. Now, dead body that includes touching it or being in the same room as the dead body exists. We read that earlier in the Torah. So they have conduct. So if a person's a dead body in a house or a view or for viewing or whatever, however they do it, you cannot be in the same room as it if you're a regular priest, unless it happens to be amongst these particular family members. That's verse 6 verses. Now, the high priest, however, in verse 10 and 11 and through 12, actually, it says verse 11. Verse 11, the high priest says, he should not come near any dead person. He should not commit himself to his father or his mother. So the high priest, in pretty much any funeral, is apt. And he should not leave sanctuary, for he should not desecrate the sanctuary of his God, for a crown that oil God's from his head. I am Jehovah. The high priest doesn't get to go. If you recall, Aaron lost his two sons, Nadab and Abihu, when he was there, the high priest. And what did Moses tell him? Don't mourn. Don't contaminate yourself. Finish your job. Let everybody else mourn. You do your job. So he, though losing two of his sons, was not to attend their funerals. Hard place to be as a high priest. You have children, you have a spouse, you have brothers, you have parents. When they pass away, you aren't there. It's not an easy thing to do. That's a requirement for the high priests. So pretty much any funeral, with the exception of his own, of course, he's not allowed to attend. He's pretty much out of them. Now, also additionally, in both in the first six verses of 21 as well as through 10 to 12, neither high priest nor ordinary priests are allowed to make a bald spot or do any of that kind of stuff on their heads when somebody's died. Now, in this bald spot tradition, I do believe many people have discussed this. This is the idea or the concept is you will shave your head for mourning. If you recall correctly, we have read this previously, that when the, actually, I think it comes into Numbers. I think it's with Numbers, if I recall correctly. It discusses that when a soldier of Israel comes and captures a female from the opposing army or whatever, and that she is allowed to shave her head for a month and mourn the loss of her parents and her, basically her family, her brothers, sisters, that kind of thing, in that process of her mourning. And then after the 30 days, then you may actually marry her if you wish. But prior to that, you may not, and she must be allowed to do so. So the shaving one's head apparently is a common event at that time, not so much necessarily now, but it was then. So the priests are not to do so, even though they may lose their family, friends, or loved ones. That is not permitted. Now, that's on their head or the corners of their beard. Now, this is not to be confused with the prohibition of not cutting your beard. The idea that I'm not trying to pick on any particular group or peoples, but I don't remember what to call it, but the locks, which is the side of Orthodox Jewish men, they have inside their heads. This appears, at least, to be an inappropriate application of this. And I say that because we learned from Ezekiel 44 that, first of all, the high priest may not have such things. His head of his hair, all of his head is hair, is this here in our Torah portion. The beard, everything must be well trimmed. So well kept, short, not shaved, and not long. It has to be well trimmed. His whole head is well trimmed. The high priest, so the regular priest, not specify their whole has to be well trimmed yet, but it does specify that they are not to have things shaved. In Ezekiel chapter 44, it expands this process. So Ezekiel 44, verse 20. Let's see if I can go there. Find Ezekiel 44 real quick. Hold on a minute. I should read it to you, just so we're all on the same page. Ezekiel 44, one of the most controversial books in the era of the Bible. Ezekiel 44 is jumping to, let's see here. We'll read this whole section in a minute, but just the one verse. It specifies this. Okay. So this is 44, verse 20. It says in Ezekiel 44, nor shall they, this referring to the sons of Zadok, the high priests, Nor shall they shave their heads or let their hair grow long, but they shall keep their hair well trimmed. Now, in this instance, Ezekiel 44, I say it's a controversial topic because he has it specified here for all the descendants of Zadok, which we call them in Sadducees. All the descendants, they are to have their hair trimmed and not long. That was not a requirement of the Torah. That was specifically stated for the high priest only, but he is specifying that all their descendants of the high priest's families are to do the same thing. Even though they may not be eligible for high priest, they are to continue on that practice. So he expanded in that capacity. It's not necessarily wrong, but that's just what it's done. So all the hair must be well trimmed, regardless of their priestly category from Ezekiel 44. So well-trimmed hair is required. Now, again, this is in the context of mourning for someone, but it still apparently is inclusive of whether you are mourning or not mourning for the loss of a loved one. And of course, high priest is not allowed to do anything in that fund. That is the extent of the death of relatives. Back to my... There it is. So the next section is the marriages, which Rose had asked about a little bit regarding the inappropriate wife for the high priest. In Leviticus 21, verse 7 through 9, as well as 13 through 16, discusses the regular priests and then the high priest. So in the who you can or cannot marry. Now, this is not a stipulation upon the rest of Israelites. The ordinary people, this does not apply. Ordinary people of some other tribe or some other group, this is not for them. This is specifically for the priests. Now, and you'll notice here that Moses had to speak to the Aaron as well as the Israelites. So this is a dual responsibility. And that the priest's response to make sure they choose wisely, but also the people are responsible to make sure the priests choose wisely. I'm not sure how many of you have experienced that yourself, having somebody said, yeah, you really shouldn't do that. But I've experienced it myself in years past and at various times in my life, and somebody says, yeah, I don't think it's a good idea. And it turned out it really wasn't. I should have listened. My wife did that quite regularly. That's how it is. Anyway, so in this case, so no priest, this is Leviticus 21, verse 9, 7 through 9. No priest, whether high priest or anybody else, is allowed to marry a harlot or a desecrated woman. Now we have to ask ourselves, what is a desecrated woman? It's separate from a harlot. A harlot is obviously one who sleeps around for money. A desecrated woman may not necessarily be. So a desecrated woman includes anyone who is, as we see here, a product of an illicit relationship. So let's say one man and one woman who are unmarried have a child. And that marriage is not permitted marriage. Regarding, for example, you have illicit relationships of potentially an adulterous situation or two people who are not permitted to marry. For example, an aunt and a nephew or some semi-incestuous relationship. Any product of that is grouped as a desecrated woman. So they are not permitted to marry them. No priest is allowed to marry a desecrated woman, nor a divorced woman. Disregarding the priest. Like I said, this is not applicable to the rest of the Israelites. This is just the priest category. Now, a normal priest, however, is permitted wives, the wives they can have, could obviously virgins. A widow is permittable for a normal priest, or possibly non-virgin female. So, yeah, so what is that? So there are instances of where a young woman, presumably, may not be a virgin anymore, but she was not a harlot. Now, I have this written up here, depending on interpretation. So I wrote this other because that is not how I would necessarily read it, but that's how it is commonly read in Jewish tradition, that you can be a non-virgin and still not be desecrated and not be widowed or divorced. You may have had an indiscretion activity when you were a child or when you were young and you shouldn't have, and you did it anyway, and you regret it, you repented. So no priests may be permitted that category. I'm not saying that's correct. I'm just saying that's how Judaism has interpreted it over the past couple thousand years. You can decide if that's right or wrong, but that's why I say the word possibly non-virgin. Now, a high priest, however, that is not the case. High priest permitted only to marry a virgin who is not desecrated. So she's a virgin, female, and I didn't list it here, but also part of the people. So you can't go marry some other country member. So she cannot be a product of an illicit relationship. So she can't be like an offspring of some inappropriate conduct or some affair that happened. She's the offspring of it. Can't do that. Ezekiel 44 in verse 22 adds another detail, another category, which was not permitted. So we'll read this eventually more thoroughly. But Ezekiel 44 verse 22, Ezekiel explains, hey, there's an additional requirement, or sorry, additional loophole, additional open door for high priest families. It says in Ezekiel 44 verse 22, it says they, for the high priest's families, all their sons, all their males, they should not take a wife as a widow or divorced woman, but take virgin descendants of Israel, the house of Israel, or widows of priests. So in this case, Ezekiel 44 says, hey, there's a section or a category where the high priest's family, their sons, are allowed to marry widows only if the widow is a widow of another priest. Now, that is not within the Torah, but that's what it says here in Ezekiel 44. We can discuss what that means. Actually, we probably should discuss it now as well. Yeah, let's discuss that now so we have the opportunity. So let's jump to Ezekiel 44 and just read the Haftorah portion so we're on the same page of what this means. So Ezekiel 44, mind you, I mentioned before, Ezekiel is of the priestly lines of families. He is very familiar with the requirements of the temple service. He is, at this time in his life, as he's reading, he is living in the country, in the Babylonian territory, as he's one of the captives. He is prophesying to, it says, the house of Israel, but in reality, if you read all of his prophecies, he's only talking to the tribe of Judah. So it's an interesting dynamic, though it says he speak the house of Israel, but he only, every message he gives is strictly to the tribe of Judah, the southern tribe. He never actually speaks to the house of Israel ever in any of these prophecies, because he never visits them. He discusses where he goes. Every place he goes, all occupied by the house of Judah. None of them are occupied by the Israelites. So Ezekiel 44, verse 15, says the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok, who kept charge of my sanctuary when the children of Israel went astray from me, they shall come near to me to minister to me. They shall stand before me to offer to me the fat and the blood, says Jehovah. They shall enter my sanctuary, and they shall come near my table to minister to me, and they shall keep my charge. It shall be, whenever they enter the gates, the inner court, they shall put on linen garments. No wool shall come upon them while they are ministering within the gates of the inner court or within the house. They shall have linen turbans on their heads and linen trousers on their bodies. They shall not clothe themselves with anything that causes sweat. When they go out to the outer court to the people, they shall take off the garments in which they have ministered, leave them in the holy chambers, and put on other garments. And in their holy garments they shall not sanctify the people. Nor shall they shave their heads, nor shall let their hair grow long. They shall keep their hair well trimmed. No priest shall drink wine when he enters the inner court. They shall not take as a wife a widow or a divorced woman, but take virgins of the descendants of the house of Israel or widows of priests. They shall teach my people the difference between holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In controversies, they shall stand as judges and judge it according to my judgments. They shall keep my laws and my statutes in all my appointed meetings. They shall hallow my Sabbaths. They shall not defile themselves by coming near a dead person, only for a father or mother or a son or daughter, for a brother or unmarried sister may they defile themselves. After he is clean, they shall count 7 days for him. On the day that he goes to the sanctuary to minister in the sanctuary, he must offer his sin offering in the inner court, says Jehovah. It shall be in regard their inheritance that I am their inheritance. You shall give them no possession in Israel, for I am their possession. They shall eat the grain offering, the sin offering, the trespass offering. Every dedicated thing in Israel shall be theirs. The best of all first fruits of any kind, and every sacrifice of any kind, from all your sacrifices, shall be the priests. Also you shall give the priests the first of your ground meal, to cause a blessing to rest on your house. The priest shall not eat anything, bird or beast, that died naturally or was torn by wild animals. Ezekiel 44, that was starting in verse 15 through the end of the chapter. So in here, most was not too difficult. We understand it's pretty consistent with the Torah. The exception being who he's talking to. He specifies here the priests, the Levites, the sons of Zadok. Now, Zadok, those who don't remember, Zadok was a high priest. So he was a high priest under King Solomon, shortly after David had passed away. Actually, it's just before David. Yeah, he was, right. Because Solomon killed his brother. He sent away his brother. He didn't kill him. He sent away his brother. So Zadok became the high priest at that time. So all these sins, these men he's referring to in Ezekiel 44 are all high priest line people. So theoretically speaking, the high priest, it says quite clearly, this is ones who offer the actual offerings, the blood offerings. So he's referring to these people who are going into the temple and doing the high priest actions, the work of the high priests. Not the normal priests, but rather the high priests, that they are permitted to obviously marry widows of other priests. They are to, in this case, Ezekiel 44, so they are now, at this point in his story, permitted to even attend funerals, even though they are high priests. Attend funerals of their parents and of their the greater priests. And to ask yourselves, how on earth is it right that Ezekiel is altering the Torah? That's a dangerous thing. How is this possible? How can Ezekiel be speaking the truth? Is he making an error? Is he off on his own half-cocked idea? What's he doing? He's making a change. You can't change the Torah. That's against the Torah to change the Torah. Moses said to me, who advocates an addition or subtraction or alteration, execute them. They're to die. They are not speaking God's ways. Even if they perform miracles, great miracles. And points out, you do not change the Torah. You can't do that. Now, you can make a Torah section not applicable, meaning, for example, you can say, well, we're going to banish all forms of slavery. Okay, well, then the Torah regarding instructions for slavery doesn't apply anymore. You didn't delete it. It didn't apply to you, because you may end up some 10, 15 generations later, they may say, let's reinstate slavery again. Well, then it applies. So you can have things not apply, but you can't alter them.
Hey, Daniel, Naomi has a question.
Oh, yes, go right ahead.
Naomi?
No.
Oh, so Jared, somebody.
Yeah, I'm using my sister's Chromebook.
Oh, got it. Go ahead, Jared.
So going back just a little bit, you said that Ezekiel said that the high priest can't marry a widow unless it is from another priest. Is that right?
Well, Ezekiel, correct. They're not to marry a widow unless it is a widow of another priest.
Could that be because of the commandment in the Torah where it says if your brother marries a woman and then dies without children, then you marry your brother's wife and have children in his name? Is that possibly like...
Something? It is possible. So that's an interesting concept. Now, normally that would fall to the priests that would do that task as opposed to the high priest. So that's a fair, completely legitimate interpretation of it. Normally the high priest would be excluded from that option. The high priest cannot do such a thing, even though he may have a single brother. we'd have to choose some other relative who was nearer of kin to him. We have that example given to us in the book of Ruth, that there was someone who was near of kin to Naomi and to Ruth herself, who would be the rightful heir to redeem her. And he said, no, I'm going to deny that. I can't do that for my own, whatever reasons they are. He doesn't say what they all are. And then it falls the next one down. So normal circumstances, the high priest's family would not be able to introduce such a thing. The regular priests, who are all relatives also, it would fall to one of them, whether it be an uncle or a cousin or something else. It falls to their category instead. That's how you would normally run it. So it is possible that is the scenario which he's trying to play with. I personally have a different interpretation as to why this is going on. That's just how I view it. I'm viewing this as if you note in the book of Ezekiel, he spends an awful lot of time talking about a temple that doesn't exist. That's a future temple, a future event. He spends a lot of time doing that and discusses how the conduct and how it's designed and all the various details go with this temple that's very large in its size. And in my opinion, because you continue on reading in Ezekiel, discusses, of course, the different gates in which the prince is allowed to go through and the one that God is designated for God's presence to travel through, the holy districts and such, and properties and such, that this is a future event. Now, in my opinion, it's just my opinion, I believe this is being opened up for the high priest's families because they are no longer high priests. Though they may be descendants of, they're not actually high priests anymore in the time which Ezekiel is discussing. He's discussing a future event, some future event beyond him, beyond his lifetime. These high priests, the sons of Zadok, though they are great men and were great men, are no longer actually high priests anymore. Hence, it loosens up the category. That's my opinion. I say that because he discusses the grouping of the category of high priests that are priests doing tasks like a normal high priest would do. But if you call correctly and look back through our Torah, how many high priests were there at a time? Normally, one. Now, there was this period of time during King David where there were two. But that was a short period of time and into King Solomon's time. And Zadok was one of those two. But normally there's one. Now in this grouping here, Ezekiel 44, he's discussing all the descendants of Zadok, which we call them Sadducees today. Now at that time, when Messiah was around, how many high priests were there? Well, there were one at a time, but it was a recycling, fluctuating, spinning role that came and went, it came and went, it came and went. New person was popped in every so often. Herodians showed up and did some strange stuff. So a lot of high priests came and went. So in my opinion, I think Ezekiel's referring to the fact that these guys are actually high priests anymore. Though they're still descendants of, and they're being honored as if they are, but they're not actually high priests. That's my opinion. And my opinion is held that way because I happen to believe in a Messiah, a son of God, who is a high priest, and who would be the take care of or fulfill that role. Ezekiel calls him the prince. In his book of Ezekiel, but I believe that is the category that he falls under. So of him being the true one and only real individual high priest, then the descendants of Zadok, the regular high priest, the regular family line, are no longer actually a singular high priest anymore, but they are not exactly regular priests either. They're still in a special or strange subcategory. They've been dropped down from the high priest, the singular high priest role, to a group of priests that aren't exactly regular priests. They're still in the admitted state, but not quite as regular as ordinary priests is. They still offer offerings that only high priests are supposed to offer, but they are not quite the same grouping as a high priest. In which case, your theory, Jared, a brother dies, his wife, and they had to have a relationship with another brother, that would be perfectly legitimate now. Because now there's no, in this instance, there would no longer be an application. The high priest would have to say no. In this case, they would say, well, actually, I am eligible for that application. And that would make sense then. And that's my opinion. That I think Ezekiel is pointing out a time, a future event, where the high priests are still
high priest to form with their family, but not necessarily to form with the role they fill. They're rather the one singular high priest is what he's talking about. That's my opinion, though. So it is open to interpretation. I think it's an interesting topic to discuss. I happen to like contradictions within inside the Bible. It helps you understand things better. And it comes to a question about this particular topic. So I'm going to move on from the high priest role and move, or sorry, this marriage thing. What other topics?
Daniel, we check in with folk on the phone.
Right ahead. I can't access any of them, but you can.
Myrna?
Anne, yeah, I'm Naomi, here.
Pat? Do you folks have any questions or comments?
No, I'm just finding all the comments very interesting, and I'm learning a lot. And this is Myrna. So I'm listening and I'm learning, and I appreciate all the comments.
Good. Okay, thank you.
All right, get back to my position here. Okay. Now, the reasoning behind God. So I can't speak for him. I can only say what he said. So all the reasons that God does stuff, he has his reasons for it. Now, in Leviticus 21, there's a lot of repetition of a particular phrase. Leviticus 21, verse 9 says something very similar. 15 says it. I think it's also repeated again. I don't recall the top of the verse. The third place he repeats it. But it's Leviticus 21, verse 15, is an interesting point. God says, thus he, this is referring to the high priest, shall not desecrate his offspring, for I am Jehovah who sanctifies him. Now, there are not many instances where God or Jehovah says, the reason is I'm the one who sanctifies him or them. He says them in verse 9, for the regular priest, says him for the high priest, verse 15. This is again later on in chapter 21. Most were isolated here on purpose. It is for us to understand and know that the only reason a high priest, is because God, Jehovah, is the one who set him aside. Men don't do that. I have written down here, it's important to note that all anointed high priests are sanctified by God. I say anointed, when it means the Messiah, Mashiach, someone who's been anointed. He is the one who does the work. It doesn't matter what men do. It's what God does. He's the one who set this person aside or these groups of people aside. This includes Messiah himself. So God, the Messiah himself is Messiah because Yahweh set Messiah to be one. He set it up to do precisely that. It is not within sight of Messiah himself to be the anointed one. God is the one who must anoint him. God's one is like, I choose this one, as opposed to I choose one over there, or one over there, or this time or that. God is the one who selects them. As it pointed out, when Messiah was baptized, that's precisely what God did. He said, I'm selecting this one. So it includes not just Messiah, high priest, but the only other person who is anointed within our Bible, of course, the kings themselves. Now, humans, man, we choose kings in our country, we choose presidents pretty regularly, regardless of whether God, you know, necessarily said anoint this guy or not, we just kind of randomly vote. And then we can debate whether or not God is ultimately affects or alters those votes. But the point is, we on the surface at least, appear that we select them. Man cannot sanctify anyone. I cannot sanctify my son, or I can sanctify myself, or he can't sanctify me. God's one who does it. So it doesn't matter what we do with them or treat them. So it doesn't matter if we treat them as a king, it doesn't matter if we treat them as a priest, it doesn't treat them as anything. What we treat and how we act doesn't matter. God is the one who sets them aside. So it's important to note the reason why God does all this, or something like these high priests and the regular priests, what they can and cannot do, and all those different stuffs. The nature of it is all God set it aside. He did it. He did so. So respect it, and that's where it falls into. So when Ezekiel is coming along in 44 and says, hey, there's a time period or event that will occur that those high priests, we knock down a small step, but a step from high priest role to an action or a task role base instead of the actual intercession based role. God is the one who does this, but we do not. we can debate and say, God, you can't do that. Don't say what God can and can't do. He can do anything. So we let him decide what he wants to do. And he let him decide who his anointed one, who his high priest will be, or who his king will be, and let it leave it at that, as opposed to disagreeing with it. You can disagree if you want, but it's keep it yourself. So there's some of the details of responsibility here. So priests have their group of lists of what you can and cannot do. Well, I'm not going to read this whole section again, but in the tail end of 21 through the first half of 22, there are some responsibilities that non-priests fall under. In particular, a narrow section we'll discuss. We'll jump to chapter 22, verse 10. This affects King David and Messiah actually talked about this topic, which is very interesting to understand, which may allude to what Ezekiel 44 is talking about as well. So Leviticus 22, the small section here, so verse 10 says, no layman, refers no non-priest, shall eat of the holy. Who resides with a Kohen or his laborer shall not eat of the holy. Now, so all non-priests are going to eat of this, but those who recall King David. In 1 Samuel chapter 21, the first 9 verses, and it's continued on, the same storyline, it's continued on in 22 of 1 Samuel, verse 6 to 23, discuss the nature of what David had done. So David is something very strange, very unique. So I'll jump there real quick and read the first 9 verses of 1 Samuel chapter 21. An event which Messiah talks about as well. As he says, 1 Samuel chapter 21, it says, now David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest. And Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? So David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you to do. And I have directed my young men to such a place. Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand, or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women. Then David answered the priest and said, truly women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day. So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there but the show bread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now a certain man of the service of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I have brought neither my sword nor weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. The priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the valley of Elot, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you will take that, take it. There is no other except that one here. It is that there is none like it. Give it to me. So in 1 Samuel 21, the first 9 verses, discusses an event that David, prior to him being king, was fleeing from King Saul, of course. He had a few men with him, I don't know. He stopped to the town of Nov, which is the high priest, Ahimelech is there. And at that time, which most likely, since this bread is replaced every Shabbat, is probably a Saturday when he shows up. Say, I need bread. Now, it's commanded here in Leviticus 22 that non-priests cannot eat it, and yet David's eating it. And why did he eat it? He's hungry. That's an interesting principle. The commandments of God are commandments of God. They're not to be broken. But apparently, there are scenarios, situations, which is better to break them than to keep them. In this instance, David with his men, they were hungry. And the high priest, Ahimelech, and David knowingly broke this commandment. And actually, this commandment is repeated somewhere else too, about not eating that bread. They knowingly broke it. And in Matthew 12, look at Matthew 12, Messiah talks about this particular event. This is, there's a principle here that the commandments are important and they're not to be broken, but there are some instances where breaking of them is better than sticking to them. In Matthew chapter 12, this topic is discussed. So Matthew 12, putting verse 1, it says, this is Messiah speaking. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as his disciples were hungry and began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. When the Pharisees saw it, they said, look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. He said to them, have you not read what David did when he was hungry, and he and those who were with him? How he entered the house of God and ate the showbread, which is not lawful for him to eat, nor for those who are with him, but only for the priests? Or have you not read in the law the Sabbath, the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless? I say to you that in this place there is one greater than the temple. But if you had known what this means, quote, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the guiltless. The Son of Man is Lord even the Sabbath. So in this instance, Messiah is pointing out that, did you not notice they were hungry? So in this law, this response, this commandment that's given, there appears to be scenarios which is more valuable to break the command than it is to obey it. And this is an example of someone was hungry, so commandment was set aside to address someone who was hungry. This is reiterated or done again or often throughout history, that there are scenarios, for example, just using it as an example, you don't have to agree with it, is that it is relatively common for during the days of unleavened bread, the people who are purging their house bring their leavened bread products to food banks or to the poor and say, okay, I could feed them, I could discard this bread and throw it in the trash can, or I can feed someone who's hungry. And the value, the principle is, feed those who are hungry first. The nature of commandments are commandments, but you have to understand that there's a judgment, a mercy that's thrown in there as well, that must be looked at or examined first. What is righteous? What is justice first? Then we apply what is a commandment. If there is righteousness being applied and done, that is more valuable than the commandment itself. As the quote, if you had known this, I desire mercy and not sacrifice. I desire kindness and respectfulness and helpful to others over the actual commandment being followed. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not an advocate of breaking commandments, quite the opposite. But there are scenarios that occur, that within our Tanakh and our Torah occur, that following the commandment is less righteous than breaking it. Sounds strange, but certain principles, certain situations, that occurs. Let's move on. So in Leviticus 23, one of the most famous chapters, at least for my family it is, I'm sure for some of you as well, in our Torah, the list of most of the appointed times. These are a great list. It has, I say most, as I mentioned before, does not include the first of the month, Rosh Kodesh, but does include all the others. Now, these appointed times I mentioned before are also grouped in sevens. These appear to be grouped in sevens, and not just here. The theme of grouping in sevens does not end in 23. It continues in 24 as well as in 25, next week's Torah portion. The things that are grouped in seven seem to be all thrown together in these three chapters. Meaning, the appointed events, not all sevens, but things are appointed events. Obviously, I mentioned before, the Shabbat, an appointment to every seven-day week period. There's one appointed time, there's one day at the end of each week. Now, obviously, there are roughly 52 Shabbats a year, roughly. It depends on when your year begins or ends. But every week, so every 7 days. Shabbat is grouped in obviously groups of sevens. They're not just any random group, but a weekly group of seven. And like from Tuesday to Monday, it's Sunday through Shabbat, through Saturday. So Shabbat is the appointed time. in Leviticus 23. It's a group of sevens. Passover Matzot, the days of Matzot are 7 days long. So there's also a group of sevens here. Now there's two appointments within side Matzot. It's the Passover day, the following day of Passover, which is the first day of unleavened bread. And the last day, those are grouped into sevens. Then we have the count of the Omer, the seven sets of 7 days. Now you can debate when that begins or ends, but the nature of it is still seven sets of 7 days, making 49 days. And on the 50th day, of course, when the Shavuot is the end of it. So Shavuot, another set of sevens, is the end of the seven sets of 7 days, which there's one appointment on it, one moed, one day, which you take time off. These are all grouped into groups of sevens. Yom Teruah, now I have here my presentation of Yom Teruah is bolded. I'll explain that in a minute. But Yom Teruah is the first of the seventh month. Now, they're also grouped in sevens or attached to the seventh month. There is one appointed day in that time period. Yom Kippur is the 10th day of the seventh month. They're still grouped in sevens. It's grouped in the day of the seventh month. Is also one appointment time. And of course, Sukkot, famously, is 7 days in the seventh month. And there's one appointment, which is the first day. And the last day of appointed time, which is Shemini Atzeret, which is the last holy day in the seventh month, which is one appointment. These are all, as you can see, groups of sevens. They are seven sets or groups of sevens together. God appears to have organized or set up Leviticus 23, 24, 25, divided up into grouped all of the sevens together. We should ask ourselves the reason why. Before we get there, we have to finish off our list. The list of appointed times. There are also other appointed events, which are not necessarily times. We call them years. There are also the other objects. So the additional groups of seven, you have the menorah is listed in chapter 24, which obviously has seven branches, as the light of illumination is put upon it. We also have the showbread. Now, showbread is the menorah looks on the showbread, examines it, or looks at it for 7 straight days. Every 7 days it's replaced. So the showbread is grouped in the sevens at the same time. The seven branch menorah is looking at the seven days on the 12 loaves of bread, but they are 7 days that he's looking at it. It's looking at it. And of course, chapter 25 discusses the 7 years for land's arrest, and then the seven sets, 7 years for Jubilee. We're not getting those two events today. I'm just pointing out that they're all grouped of sevens. Why is this? Why did God group all these different holidays and all these other events, all attached up, all these appointments, all grouped into seven? Now we understand it's pretty obvious. Seven seems to be a completion or a day of rest. Well, note at these Shabbats or these other appointed times, I have listed here the actual days which you take time off. In the Shabbat, it's one appointment each week. The last of each week is one appointment. In the Passover Matzot, there are two appointments. The first of unleavened bread and the last of unleavened bread, which is the first of bread is Passover blends into that after midnight and becomes the first day of unleavened bread. So those are two appointments. The count of Omer has the days, but there is no appointment in the count of the Omers. There's no, you will take the time off or any appointments associated with it. At least not that we can understand. And then we have the Shavuot, which has one appointment. Now, in this list here, I had Yom Teruah bolded because it is the middle appointment in that you have, excluding Shabbat, which happened every week, you have just the holiday appointments. You have Matzot, the Shavuot appointment, Yom Teruah appointment, you have Yom Kippur's appointment, Sukkot is one appointment, and Shemini Atzeret is one appointment. It is common to associate these seven appointments. Yom Teruah is the one in the middle. So, for example, if you wished to symbolize or use the symbol of the menorah, you would place the Yom Teruah is the one in the middle, the center one. These are the appointed times. Now, I'm not saying these are the list of the holidays. These are appointed times. And as the holidays, we have to separate Passover, separate from Matzot. You can divide them all the terms. I'm referring to the appointed times themselves. Yom Teruah is the turning point or the threshold from the one group to the other group for appointed times. And of course, I mentioned before, the menorah, seven branches, the showbread, seven branches, the lamp, seven branches. So all these are the different sevens. Why is this? Well, there are certain explanations given to us for some of these. For example, the Shabbat 7-day rest. It's a rest released from our labor. So every 7 days, we take a day off. It's Shabbat, a day of rest. So that group of seven associates with release or resting from our labor, at least for a day. In the days of Matzot, the 7 days, in that instance, we also have rest release, but not from the same labor, but it's from bondage or sin. So the idea in that instance is you were not puffed up, not lifted up, not inflated. You're not full of yourself, so to speak. But instead, you are released from those bondages, the sin that has bonded you. So we seem to have a basic theme going on in the topics of Shabbat and Matzot, and the day of being released or not working on your labor or not stuck to your sin or not bonded up. Now, we also know from the Zechariah, as well as the book of Revelation, that the menorah's seven eyes, or seven branches, refer to seven eyes of God looking around and observing the world. Now, the seven eyes, the menorah, seven branches, seven eyes of God, in the temple, are supposed to looking at the 12 loaves of bread. Now, 12 loaves, 12 typically would associate with 12 tribes of Israel, because it's the number 12. So menorah's seven eyes of God are looking at the 12 loaves of bread, or the menorah's seven eyes of God are looking at the 12 tribes of Israel. They're observing them. They're watching them. They're looking at them, saying, hey, what you guys doing? What's going on? They look at them all week long. And then every week, they get replaced with a whole new set. Let's look at them again. So the idea is that the menorah's seven eyes are continuously watching, looking, or observing God's people. Just always looking at it, seeing what you're doing. Now, these appointed times that we mentioned earlier, all that if you're doing the matzah, the Shavuot, the different days, which we're supposed to rest from our labor and go visit with God, the appointed times are times we're supposed to spend our time with Him and either interacting, discussing, sharing, talking, whatever, with our God and communing with Him or being at one with Him. That's kind of like being looked at, being watched. So another way of looking at it is that, in my opinion, is that these seven appointments are not just appointments for us to stop what we're doing, but also for us to visit with our God, to understand or be with Him. It is an appointment. For example, let's say for pretend for a minute, you had an appointment at a doctor's office. It was for, you know, Tuesday at 3:00, right? And you show up at Tuesday at 3:00 because it's your appointment and there's no one there. Doctor's not there. Office is closed. No nurses. No one to receive you, no patients. You're there alone. An appointment with one person is not an appointment. It's to have more than one. Someone you're going to meet. So in this case, you would need at least the doctor to be there because it's an appointment with the doctor. That's the idea. Well, appointment with God is different, in my opinion. If I have an appointment with Him that's on the seventh day of the week, Shabbat, I'm going to be there and I trust He'll be there too. If it is the first day of unleavened bread or the last day, it's an appointment. I'll be there and I trust He'll be there too. It's an appointment with someone. So it has appointed times, though they're given to men, they're designed to be with Him. If you recall, at the time which Adam and Eve existed, there was an appointed time which God came to the garden and Adam and Eve were there. And God, at the appointed time, looked around and couldn't find it, and said, hey, where are you? And Adam said, well, here I am. We were hiding because we were afraid. So there's an appointed time which both God and Adam were supposed to meet. And God showed up, but Adam didn't. An appointed time. So in my viewpoint, appointed times with God are times which He says, I'm going to be there. I expect you to show up too. And I want to say, here I am. I'm here. Every appointed time. That's how I view it. So in this case, these days of release or rest from our labors is not just time to kick back, relax, go play golf. It's our go, you know, play pool or go, you know, goof off with our kids necessarily. But it's also time to say, okay, God, I'm here and you are too. Let's talk. Let's visit. Let's have a conversation. Let's discuss what you have to say. And of course, He wrote down all of His words in the book, so I should just read them. But that's the nature of what these appointments are. Then we also, he wants that Sukkot has its seven. We also have the explanation given to us. Sukkot's group of sevens for dwelling is explicitly stated as the reason was is that God would have them dwell in booths for 7 days. That they'd remember that they dwelt in the wilderness with God for those 40 years they were traveling the wilderness. So again, that explains or expands the idea that God appears to be having or wanting or desiring an appointment with us during these time periods. So not just us alone taking time off and then, well, I just won't work, I'll just go play. No, it's a time which he's going to be there too. The nature of Sukkot was that we would dwell with God in the wilderness. We didn't, but our ancestors did. And that is the intent. So the time of these appointed groups, these appointments of all these groupings of sevens being grouped together, is that their appointments are not just our rest days. All these images are days, our appointments with God, to be with him, to visit with him, to learn from him and talk with him. Much like you would an appointment with your son or your daughter to go do something, or your wife on an anniversary, you go do something together. Well, all these appointments the same way. You do something with God together. Either as a group or as individuals with him, but either way, you're with him. It's appointed times that he's there too. So the overall theme of these sevens being shoved together seems to be a time which God wants to be with us and us with him. It combines the idea of our rest, our time with him, to visit with him, to stop so we can see what he's doing, and for him to stop to see what we are doing. Visit with one another and talk. Hey, this is my life. This is what's going on. How's your life going? What can I do for you? What can you do for me? Time which you'd have a visit, a conversation, an appointment. Now we have in our little story here, we're going to conclude with this blasphemer thing. Within the tail end, our strange, this guy who cursed, God. Now we have to ask, as I ask myself, maybe you don't have to, but I ask. This group of sevens of chapter 23 and the first chapter 24, as well as continuing on to chapter 25, why on earth is this blasphemer story shoved here completely out of context? Makes no sense. It's like somebody just jammed in there, got to shove somewhere here. We'll just shove it in this leaf or this scroll. Okay, call it good. There's a flipping card where it happens to land. It seems completely out of place. So why is it here? Why is it somewhere else? For example, the guy who picked the sticks and was stoned for working on Shabbat. Well, yeah, you can show this one in the same place. Yeah, he's cursed somebody. That would be a good thematically make sense kind of group, but that's not where it's placed. It's placed here. And so the only explanation I have, and this could be totally wrong, but the reason why I think it's here is because look at the rest of the commandments given with it. If you have here listed up, it says he has to remove the blasphemer outside the camp and to kill him. But look at verse 7, he says, he has a whole other list of stuff. A man, if he strikes mortally any human life, which is death, a man who strikes mortally an animal should make restitution for it, life for life. Again, what does a striking man or striking an animal have to do with these groups of sevens? That doesn't make sense. They're out of place, right? But they're still grouped together. Verse 19. If a man inflicts a wound on his fellow, so should be done to him. A break for break, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Just as he will have inflicted a wound on a person, so should he be inflicted upon him. When he strikes the animal, shall make restitution. When he strikes a person, put to death. There should be one law for you. Should be a proselyte, a native like, for I, Yehovah, am your God. And then after getting this list of how you conduct and act and treat one another, he goes back to kill the stone the blasphemer, and then move on back to groups of sevens for sabbatical years, things like that. The reason I think they're grouped together is, as I mentioned before, it's the appointments are a time for God to look at us and us look at him. Or stop what we're doing and look what he's doing. Stop what he's doing and look, he looks what we're doing to observe us. Well, look at these laws. These lists. How does man treat man? How does man treat animals? How do we treat one another? I can go to God and say, God, I'm a great person. I do good stuff. I obey your Torah. I treat my neighbor like garbage. I do anything right, else right. I treat this guy over there I don't like. He's not a very good person anyway. He doesn't like you, so I'll just treat him like garbage too. Do I want God to see that? at my appointed time, what do I have to show him? Do I have to show him, oh, my book I'm reading? See, I read through 8 chapters today. Good job. So what? What am I going to show him? My appointed times. What do I give him? All I have is my conduct. How do I treat others? How do I treat God? How do I treat one another? And this is where I believe these appointments, which are appear to be time which us with God and God with us, show up here. And God says, hey, watch your conduct. That's what I'm looking at. That's what God's looking for. He's paying attention to. Yes, Jeff.
I wonder if this is also grouped in here with the 7 and what you're talking about with the themes of resolving things, is that basically you do bring these sorts of rifts between people and yourself to a close. You resolve them. You take care of them. You finish them.
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's a great, 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 great comment. All these events we have against one another. Do you wish to go to God with this thing on your shoulder saying, I did such against so-and-so and yeah, well, God will ignore that. Will he? Or do you need to go address it? Take care of it first. I believe that was when the Messiah pointed out, you know, leave yourself to offer at the door and then go do it with your fellow first before you offer something to God. So our conduct is an important component, apparently, in how we treat others as far as what God's looking for when he visits with us at our appointed times. At his appointed times. Hopefully it makes sense. This is what I want to talk about so far. I'm not time really to discuss much else. I wanted to discuss a little about Shavuot, but I'm going to call it good. It's been over an hour. So any comments or questions regarding this Torah portion? It's pretty straightforward, nothing too complicated in it. Just the different groupings of conduct and how people treat one another and each other and themselves, as well as the, I find most interesting in this, other than, of course, how we conduct ourselves, but that there are scenarios, situations, as I pointed out earlier, where the commandments are important and vital to uphold, but there's scenarios we have to pay attention to, make judgment calls. Okay, is it better to uphold the commandment or help someone? Besides the exact same thing, when you point out when you're ox in a ditch, you have a commandment, but you also have the animal that needs help. And who would not help the animal? So the same principle, someone needs help. The commandments are there to live by, but there are all scenarios where you have to decide because it's more right to break it than it is to obey it. Interesting though. Any questions or comments?
Larry has a comment.
I have a question. This is Priscilla. Yes.
Go ahead.
The Samaritan, you know, remember the Samaritan and he stopped and the priest went on the other side?
Correct.
Was there, I mean, there was no commandment not to have anything to do with the man who fell in bad way, right? I mean, there was nothing in the law about that. What was the point he was making about that? I mean, he obviously went over there, the man who was the Samaritan.
Right.
Which wasn't like a good, wasn't exactly accepted class or people or, right? Or am
right.
I wrong?
Right. So basic history, the real basic stuff. So Samaritans are non-Jews. They're not Israelites mm-hmm. either. They are a group of people who have no biological relation to the descendants of Abraham. There may be a few scattered amongst them, but not many. Most of them were non. And they were imports from other regions. Most of them were still Semitic. I mean, they're still descendants of that family line, but they weren't not necessarily any descendant of Abraham at all. There may have been a few, but most were not. So, they came up to the area, and if you recall, I believe it's recorded in the book of Jeremiah, discusses this. They showed up and they were confused by the land, said, hey, we're here. We're trying to do what our king of Nebuchadnezzar, I think it was Nebuchadnezzar who put them there. Or it could have been the Assyrians. I forgot which one. So one of them put them there, could have been Sennacherib. Put them there to implant them into northern Israel and to replace the Israelites who were captured, taken away. Not tribe of Judah, mind you, but the northern Israelites. And the Spirit showed up and said, okay, we're confused. We try to obey our normal God-worshipping practices, which is our pagan gods. And this God here is sending lions and destroying our crops and we don't deal with this. So they had to add local Jews from Judah, as well as a few of the Israelites who were still around. Okay, who is your God and what does he expect us to do so we can survive? And they explained a little bit about the God of the Bible. And so the Samaritans blended their pagan gods with the God of the Bible, is what the Israelites told them. So they have a funky, weird, blended mixture. So the Samaritans were not looked well upon because, number one, they did not obey the God of the Bible in any real capacity. And number two, there were no biological relation to the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob descendants. So they were a low-class group of people. They were not even permitted to be along with Jews because they were actually a type of Gentile with their blended religion, literally blended religion. So the Samaritans were not looked well upon. But his example that he gave with the high priest and then the Levite and the Samaritan was that the high priest... High priest, which is priest. I could be wrong. He just said priest. I don't think he said
just a priest.
Just priest. Thank you, priest. So if the man that is injured on the side, in fact, does die in the priest's presence, that priest is unclean for 7 days because he's touched a dead body. But if he doesn't die, he just has blood on him from a human, he's unclean until evening. So yeah, see, wherever he's traveling, presumably to Jerusalem, he cannot participate in whatever he's going to go do at Jerusalem. So he valued his participation in that conduct, the act of obeying the commandments of staying clean, more valuable than the individual who needed help. Now, given the Levite had a slightly different grouping, so that they had a lesser requirement than a priest. Levite, nothing more than an individual who was a servant inside the temple. So Levites could serve, but they were not priests. So they could, bring water and do the woodwork and take care of the animals, things like that nature. But they were not priests per se, but they still remained clean. So the Levite valued remaining clean, don't touch the human blood and don't touch a dead body, over taking care of somebody who was injured or damaged. The Samaritan had no such requirement. He was not going to priest for any reason. And so it doesn't matter to him. He just saw someone who was injured. Now, besides point out that seeing someone is injured, the Samaritan, who is a Gentile, a non-funky, weird, blend, virtually pagan-worshipping kind of person, he valued the person's life and their well-being over the functionality of what the Samaritan was doing. Wherever he was going to go, he was going to go to the market, who knows? Whatever his task was, he felt this person's life was more valuable. Now, he valued someone, he valued a human over his own lists or priorities or needs or wants. And the others valued their perceived commandment, needs, and wants more valuable to the person. That was the problem. Hope that makes sense.
So this it reminds me of what you were just teaching earlier about, eating the showbread and then going through the field and eating, it's a cousin almost,
They're very, very similar.
Trying
to obey the commandment to its extreme letter to which it was what they were valuing as opposed to the actual individual who needed help. Valuing the person who needed help was more important. Larry, you had a question earlier, or was that incorrect?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I was wondering when it said that when David went into the eat the showbread, that was showbread that had been replaced by fresh showbread.
Correct.
So I'm wondering, is that still off limits to them?
Yeah, in the Torah, which it discusses showbread. I don't remember which chapter it is, the nature of how it's made and how much oil goes into it, that kind of thing, and how long it's displayed for. It specifies that when it is swapped out, the stuff that was taken out off the table is strictly for the priest and his family only. It has to be his children, his wife, himself. They're the only ones who are allowed to eat it. No one else is allowed to eat it. So it is specified, even though it was swapped out, it still required that only the priest can eat it. There is exception being someone who he purchased I believe if I recall correctly, it says if he purchased someone like a slave, the high priest purchased a slave, then the slave could eat it too. And that's pretty much it. Everybody else, that is, they're strictly forbidden. So they didn't officially break the law, even though David, it's practically common now. Well, okay, David, you can say that, but in fact, it was not common. It was specifically for the priests and his family. So we could debate David's arguing skills, but they were a bit questionable at times. But he used them quite frequently. He wouldn't make a good lawyer. But yeah, so he did break the rules on that one. And the priest knowingly did so too. The high priest was there. He knew this is not against the rules. The priest said, well, at least have you no one had any female interaction? And he said, yes, for 3 days. Okay, well then here. So the priest made a judgment call. Now, I'm not condemning the priest. He made a judgment call. He said, well, at least to some semblance, some semi kind of sort of cleanliness. Yeah, there is a sort of cleanliness, semi kind of sort of. Good enough. We'll let you eat it.
They were all armed too, probably.
They're all armed with their blood weapons.
Well, you know, Messiah kind of alluded to the fact that the priests in the temple violated the Sabbath, and of course he and his disciples, his apostles, were even in a higher position, really. But he didn't say that outright. But I wondered if he kind of meant that.
It's an interesting position. At that point, you know, it's all debate, theological debate, as far as what category someone falls under at that time.
Larry, kind of to your point, that's one of the things it does talk about in there is that the repeated point of something greater than the temple is here. Mm-hmm. That's, I guess you would say, is the punchline of that passage.
Right. Hope it makes sense. Any comments or questions regarding this Torah portion?
Check out the people on the phone here.
Daniel?
Yes, Myrna, I can hear you.
I think that this lesson was very, very practical to each of us, and I really appreciate it. It brings to mind a scripture that has been one that has followed me all of my life, and it's from Micah, and it is, you know, O man, what is God, what is good, what does the Lord require of me? To live justly, to have mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And I think that's exactly what God is saying in this, that we know deep down within us what is good and what we should do. And sometimes it does take a judgment on our part. But we know within us what is good. And that's been a prayer, especially with dealing with my children, is that, dear God, show me what is good and what is just and give me mercy. And so I think this illustrates what God is really trying to say, that deep down he will help us know what is good.
That's the nature of the Spirit. That's its functionality. Makes you to understand how things are working, how to make it work well.
Yes. So thank you for your comments. It just supports what I have believed for since I was a little kid, when I could read the Bible and take it literally. Good. I wasn't. Anyway, thank you.
Good. Anything else you want to share? Anybody else to share something? Any questions or comments that we didn't get to? All right, then we'll go into our go ahead and conclude, and we'll have our last dances to go through there. Almighty God, thank you for being kind to us and showing us what is fair, what is just, to help us obey your ways, to listen to your voice, wherever it leads. We know that you are in charge. To help us be kind to one another and obedient to your ways as best we know, Father, but also help us understand compassion and mercy in the time which it is to follow wherever you lead, though it may not be easily understood or seen by us. We trust you, Father, for you are wise, and we wish to be your servants. Bless us the rest of our Shabbat, Father. We praise in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.